I'm going to start off with a question. What's the craziest thing you would do for power? For me, the idea of a public campaign is already jarring enough, so I can't imagine doing much more than that.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. The idea of running and putting myself on a poster and telling people to vote for me is the most terrifying thing I could ever think of.
Well, on October 19th, 1998, a small town outside of Monterey, Tennessee, was about to learn that one of their own was willing to do a whole lot more to hold political office, even if it meant winning, as the prosecutors would eventually put it, with a bullet instead of a ballot. This is the story of Byron Looper, the man whose hate-filled campaign for state senate ended in the assassination of Senator Tommy Burke. She's Sarah.
She's Harley.
And we're gaveling in another session of Crime in Congress. Byron Anthony Looper was born September 15, 1964, in Cookeville, Tennessee, to parents Reba and Aaron Looper. While he was born in Putnam County, Tennessee, he grew up in Georgia, and his dad worked in education, serving as a superintendent of the school system. There isn't much information about his childhood or teen years. At the sentencing phase of trial, his cousin Carol Wilson would testify that Byron's parents had divorced when he was a teenager. His father had begun drinking, which troubled the defendant. He said that Byron had called her many times, saying that he was afraid for his life. He said that they're all out to get me, all the people in Cookeville. She believed that Byron was paranoid and in need of treatment. His mother, Reba, went on to corroborate this story, testifying that Byron thought everyone was following him and hated him, and that he was really nervous. Whether Byron's father ever put his life in danger is unknown, but it suffices to say that Byron's home life and mental state were at best unstable. After graduating high school in 1963, Byron attended West Point, a very prestigious military academy in New York, but was discharged after only 2 years due to a serious knee injury. After his honorable discharge in 1985, Byron moved to Georgia and studied at none other than Sarah's own alma mater, the University of Georgia.
Go Dogs! For the listener, I won't bark in your ear, but just know if you were here in person, I would also bark at you.
Thank you. After graduation, Byron wasted no time pursuing his political ambitions. In 1988, he unsuccessfully ran for the Georgia State House as a Democrat, but lost in the primary to Wick Orr. Orr would go on to serve in the Georgia State House of Representatives until 1993. This early loss did not deter Byron from continuing in the world of politics. He re-enrolled in school, this time pursuing a master's degree from Mercer University in Atlanta, and held office for the university's Young Democrats organization. He also volunteered on Al Gore's presidential nomination campaign in 1988 and the Clinton-Gore presidential campaign in 1992. In 1994, 2 years after volunteering on the Clinton-Gore campaign, Byron decided he would revive his political ambitions. This is the first time where we start to see exactly what type of politician he is, or at least aspires to be, because he hasn't held office yet. Because his motivations to run appear less based on ideology and more based on his own desire for power, no matter the cost. Instead of running for office in Georgia as a Democrat, like he did previously, he moved back to Cookeville, Tennessee, to run as a Republican for the Tennessee House of Representatives.
Whoa. He's running as a Republican? I thought he was a Democrat.
He still has his eyes set on the state legislature. That hasn't changed. But this time in a different state and for a different party. No real explanation. Unfortunately for Byron, he loses that election to incumbent Jerry Hargrove, who, for those interested, was a Democrat who held the seat from 1991 to 2007, and served as Tennessee House Commerce Committee Chairman. At this point, Byron has 2 losses under his belt, and he's not interested in adding a third. Instead of shooting for state legislator, like he had twice before, he set his sights a little lower, Putnam County Tax Assessor. In 1996, he runs against a 14-year incumbent, makes 0 appearances during the entire campaign, and wins. Can you guess how?
I don't know. Did the incumbent die?
His campaign relied heavily on negative campaign ads, which by today's standards wouldn't be too surprising. But for the time, and when you consider that it was a campaign for local office, which is typically nonpartisan, this was unheard of in Cookeville or Putnam County. But Byron was tired of losing and did not want to leave anything to chance. He even took his campaign a step further by legally changing his middle name from Anthony, a standard middle name, to Lotax with parentheses. When people were voting for Putnam County tax assessor, they chose Byron in parentheses Lotax Looper because, I mean, why wouldn't they? Notably, however, the tax assessor does not set tax rates, but the campaign slogan still worked. I want to take a quick pause here and say that while this sounds crazy, and it is, the politics of names on ballots actually gets pretty contentious and can be a divisive topic. If you're interested in jumping down a non-crime related rabbit hole, I suggest this one. I actually spoke to a current politician once who now goes by a different name, just so that they would appear first on the ballot.
Speaking of name changes, and this is not about getting on the ballot first, but did anyone catch that recent story that Nikki Haley renamed her husband?
I mean, she's kind of right. He does look like a Michael.
No, he does. I just wondered the thought process if it had anything to do with, like, her, you know, her goals of becoming, you know, someone of public office, right?
Or maybe she just said, if I have to take your last name, I get to choose your first name.
I mean, listen.
I could be down for that, actually. That
I'm not mad at her.
Finally, Byron was in office, even if it didn't have all the power and pomp of his dream jobs. Unfortunately, instead of making the most of this position, which he did successfully run and was elected for, he almost immediately proved that he had no interest in doing the job of a tax assessor. He rarely showed up to work and had irregularities on his property tax assessments. He was also accused of remodeling his home on county time and using county money to buy political database software. With this information, it should surprise no one that in March of 1998, after being investigated by the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations, he was indicted on 14 counts of official misconduct, theft of services, and official oppression for theft, misuse of county property, and misuse of county employees.
Listen, he walked so George Santos could run.
That he did. This would be bad news for just about anyone in any situation, but it was especially bad timing for Byron, who was in the middle of a primary campaign, or should I say primary campaigns, for both Tennessee's 6th Congressional District and the Tennessee State Senate. At the time, Tennessee's 6th Congressional District was represented by Democrat Bart Gordon. And a little fun tidbit here, he took the seat after Al Gore, who held it before him, retired. The seat is currently held by Republican John Rose. This is a pretty historic seat. Tennessee's 6th was used to some big names representing them in Washington. And if Cookeville wasn't already questioning whether or not to cast their ballots in Looper's direction after 14 indictments, he was also being sued by a former girlfriend for $1.2 million. I'm going to do a little trigger warning here for sexual assault, so skip ahead about 30 seconds if you don't want to hear that. The girlfriend, whose name wasn't widely reported, so I decided to leave it out, alleged that she was pregnant and gave birth after Looper raped her, and that he used his official resources as Putnam County tax assessor to steal her house. To make a disgusting situation even grosser, a Newsweek article reported that Looper portrayed the ex-girlfriend as his wife in campaign ads. He would eventually admit to being the child's father, but only after a DNA test and being threatened with a lawsuit, though I couldn't get clarification on whether it was this lawsuit or a different one. Facing these crimes and more, Byron decided it was time to hire a campaign manager. In July 1998, he ran an ad in Campaign and Elections for, quote, a campaign staff or manager for a first-tier campaign. William Lindsay Adams applied for the job, and 3 days after faxing in his resume, he received a call from Looper himself. Adams had staffed campaigns before and often became familiar with new jobs through postings like these and word of mouth. So even though today it might be weird to place an ad like this in the paper, at the time it was completely normal.
1998.
Gotta love it. This phone call between Adams and Looper was strange, and I want to do it justice. So I'm going to read the account of this phone call from a case brief that quotes Adams' court testimony. I'll link the case brief in the episode notes. It reads, Adam received a telephone call from a person identifying himself as Byron Looper, who said he had changed his name to Low Tax Looper. The caller said that he was a candidate for the state Senate. After some conversation that included very detailed questions about concealed carry laws, Adam wasn't sure if Looper was serious or not. So he asked him, how much do you think it will cost to run a race? Looper said the race would cost him 35 cents. Adams did not ask for an explanation because the conversation was awkward, with a lot of pauses. Adams testified how the caller said he would win the race. He suggested that maybe if a candidate wasn't in the race at the end, if something happened to the candidate, that the race wouldn't cost that much to run, which was my concern, the money. Don't worry, though. Adams turned down the job. And in case there was any questioning as to whether Looper was referring to the price of a bullet when he said the election would cost 35 cents, the average cost for a shotgun shell today is about 60 cents, but would have only been 30 cents in 1998. Let's take stock here. It's July, 1 month before the primary, and not only is Looper already sending vague threats to his political opponents, but he's also tossing these ideas out to essentially strangers on the phone. It's absolutely bizarre behavior. Did someone say premeditation?
Yeah, this is insane. And wait, was this whole exchange just about his congressional campaign? Wasn't he running another one?
He was, but this exchange actually was about his state Senate campaign.
He
didn't seem interested in having too much of an operation for his congressional campaign. Needless to say, Byron lost his bid for Congress, coming in third out of four with less than 20% of the vote. Shout out to the people of Tennessee 6th. Y'all made a good call on this one. But that wasn't the end of the road for Byron. Did I mention that he was unopposed in his campaign for state Senate?
No, you did not.
In August 1998, 5 months after being indicted on 14 counts of misconduct in his current office, Byron won his primary race for state Senate after running against and beating no one. But hey, a win's a win, and Looper was ready to finally get a chance to run in a general election for statewide office. He'd already lost this opportunity twice and was not about to let the third slip through his fingers. This sets the stage for what would be a vitriolic and deadly campaign against Democratic State Senator Tommy Burke, the incumbent who'd represented Putnam County for 28 years.
Who is Senator Tommy Burke?
By many accounts, Burke was a well-liked man, even though he often endorsed controversial policies. Referred to as a conservative Democrat, Burke was an abortion hardliner, even going so far as to introduce a bill that would criminalize abortion in all cases except life of the mother. He also endorsed a law that would require drunk drivers to wear a vest saying, "I am a drunk driver," while performing community service, and urged for the passage of a bill that would have made it legal to fire a teacher for teaching evolution.
Okay, so some radical ideas.
Yes, even for the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But in a Nashville Scene article by Stephen Elliott, which I'll link below, his colleagues described him as, quote, salt of the earth. Ken Renner, who interacted with Burks as a newspaper reporter on Capitol Hill and later as communications director for Governor Ned Ray McWhirter, he said, "He may have disagreed with you on the issues, but he was never disagreeable about it. He was always nice and respectful to people and expected that from other people as well." From this description, I get the sense that he was kind of the opposite of Looper. As we've seen, Looper has no real beliefs or loyalties. He'll run in any state, for any party, and for any seat. And people who knew him in his personal life didn't have great things to say about him. But Burke, on the other hand, had his principles, albeit controversial ones, and was a generally well-liked person. In his private life, Burke was a farmer. He and his wife, Charlotte, lived in Cumberland County, Tennessee for 30 years. Cumberland County abuts Putnam County, where Looper served as tax assessor. That same colleague I quoted previously, Ken Renner, said Burks would wake up, feed his hogs, milk his cows, and complete other work on the farm before making the nearly 100-mile drive from Monterey to the state capitol. The morning of Burke's death, that's exactly what he was doing. But before I dive into the assassination, I need to establish a timeline of Looper's actions leading up to it, as it would play a critical role in the prosecution's case against Byron. Sergeant Joseph H. Bond was a Marine recruiter from Hot Springs, Arkansas. He and Looper were boyhood friends, meeting in the ninth grade when they were 14. They didn't remain super close in their early adult life, seeing each other less than 5 times between high school graduation in 1983 and 1998. So you know how it is. Friends from childhood kind of lose touch. Pretty old story.
Yeah, sure. Especially, you know, back then before we had texting and Snapchat and all that
too. Oh, yeah, that's right? A good point. Out of the blue, in 1998, Looper calls up Bond wanting to reconnect. The two talk a couple times and make plans for Looper to visit Bond at his home in Arkansas. That visit actually made it out of the group chat, or I guess email chain, and Looper went to stay with Bond in June 1998.
So this is after he lost his congressional primary and won his state Senate primary?
The primaries were held in August, so at this point he's still a candidate for both seats. However, my sense is that because he was unopposed for the one seat, that's kind of where most of his focus was.
Okay.
It was on this trip that Bond would learn that Looper was running for office, but that's not necessarily what stood out to Bond most about their conversations that weekend. I'm again going to quote here from a case brief that quotes Bond's testimony in court. He said that Byron spoke of his interest in firearms, saying that he had been thinking about getting one. He questioned Bond about the specifics of firearms, different calibers, how accurate they were, the ranges on them, and asked about silencers, as well as concealability, what would be concealable in a crowd. Remember that Bond is a Marine, meaning it might not have been odd for Looper to assume he had some knowledge about firearms. What really stands out to me in all of this is that he was asking about silencers and concealability. It seems like he's already starting to insinuate that he wants this gun for a nefarious purpose. In case there was any question about his intention, however, Bond went on to testify that Looper said that he had thought about killing his political opponent. Additionally, he said if there were only 2 people on the ballot, if one of them died 30 days before the election, he would automatically win. Tennessee had a law that if a candidate died within 30 days of an election, that the candidate's name would be removed from the ballot and the party could not nominate another person.
Now, is this still the case?
Fortunately, no.
Okay, good.
But what Bond is saying here, and this is a sworn testimony, is that back in June 1998, 2 full months before Burke's assassination, that Looper, who was running unopposed in the primary race to take on Burke, was talking about killing his opponent within 30 days of the election so that he could secure his seat in the state Senate. And remember his previous conversation where he said the race was going to cost 35 cents. A month or two later, Bond says in court that it was either July or August of 1998. Looper made an unannounced visit at Bond's house, where he stayed for a couple of days. That's my personal nightmare. Bond testified that Looper, quote, was more intent on getting a weapon, since the election was coming up. He needed one quick. This is the part where I start side-eyeing Bond a little bit, because not only did he just write these comments off, but he also agreed to get a pistol for Looper, who sent him a $150 money order as payment. Now, in Bond's defense, he did not get Looper a weapon and testified that he never planned on following through with the purchase, saying, quote, the election would go ahead and happen, and that would be it, and I wouldn't hear anything else about it. Bond would go on to be a key witness for the prosecution and, by all accounts, seemed to fully cooperate. While it's great that Bond didn't supply Looper with the murder weapon, he is far from the hero in this story. And it's frustrating that he didn't say something earlier, the first time his friend expressed a desire to kill. In that Nashville Scene article I mentioned earlier, District Attorney Gibson said, quote, Bond didn't think he was helping plan a murder. He thought he was just talking BS with a nutcase friend of his. He went on to say there was never anything to implicate Bond and that those trees got shook pretty hard by the defense. If someone makes statements like this, take them seriously, because non-serious people don't make plans and pay someone for a weapon to commit a crime like this.
Especially, and talk about it repeatedly.
Regardless, Bond did not follow through with providing Looper with a weapon, despite Looper calling him nearly every day. But once again, Byron was undeterred. On a foggy October morning, the 19th to be exact, the Burks overslept, so Tommy was not able to take his grandson to Hardee's for breakfast like he did every day. There was a group of children coming to the farm for a hayride to the pumpkin patch between 9 and 9:30 a.m. Tommy woke up, briefly spoke with one of his daughters on the phone. My guess is this is probably about oversleeping for Hardee's, don't know that for sure, and left for the pumpkin patch. I don't know exactly what time he left, but based on timestamps later in the day, I'm guessing it was in the 7 a.m. hour. Around the same time, the Burke's farmhand, 24-year-old Wesley Rex, was driving up the road to work. As he made his way up the farm road, he saw an unfamiliar black Audi driving down the road before turning around. So Wesley's going up the road, he sees a black Audi driving down the road, and then it turns so that now they're facing the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, we're talking about farm roads here, likely dirt roads. So unfamiliar vehicles were a rare occurrence that would definitely stand out. Finding this odd, he pulled over. At the same time, Tommy Burke, the owner of the farm, pulled his truck up next to Rex and asked if he knew who was driving the black car. Rex said no and proceeded back up the farm road. As he glanced behind him, he saw the black vehicle pull up beside Burke's gray pickup. Rex kept driving when he heard a pop. He assumed it was just the gravel, but when he looked behind him, he saw the Audi speeding pretty fast toward him before turning to get on the highway. Still, Rex wasn't too concerned, and before you judge him, it is worth noting that Rex had a cognitive disability, so I'm not going to speculate as to whether he should have known something was wrong before he did. Rex continued up to the hay wagon, which he got all fixed up for the children, and then went back to the barn. He eventually made his way back down to where the truck was, and I'm going to directly quote his testimony at trial, where he discusses what he saw. And so I went on through and got the tractor. I come back out the same road on the tractor, and I got up there to Tommy's truck, and I seen that there was some blood on his ear. And I thought there was something wrong, so I got off the tractor and checked him. I sort of touched him, and I noticed. I said, well, I need to go tell Kim. By Kim, he means Kim Baylock, who was the oldest of Tommy Burke's three daughters and lived just down the road. Rex went to Kim's house, told her to call 911, and then went to tell Tommy's wife that something was wrong, who was much closer than he expected. At 8:30 a.m., Tommy's wife, Charlotte, left her house to join her husband at the pumpkin patch. As she drove, she saw Rex speeding off the farm road. Immediately, Charlotte knew something was wrong and jumped out of her car to talk to the young farmhand. When Charlotte finally made it to her husband's side, she says, quote, I didn't know what had happened to him until I was holding him, and I felt the back of his head, and he had a big knot on the back of his head, and I looked at his face, and I could see the hole.
Oh, God.
The hole she's referring to was a single gunshot wound to the head caused by a Smith & Wesson 9mm pistol. Coincidentally, miles away in his recently purchased black Audi, Looper tossed a 9mm Smith & Wesson pistol out of his window on the side of the road, and later tossed the magazine into a river before driving to see his good old friend, Joe Bond.
What a brazen crime. Like at what, 7 a.m. during the weekend?
Sarah, it's even worse. This happened on a Monday morning. I can barely get myself out of bed on a Monday morning. Clearly Tommy struggled, he overslept. But somehow, this man has the motivation to commit a whole-ass murder.
Bananas and despicable.
Bizarre. By 9 a.m., police, several members of the Burke family, and emergency personnel were at the scene. In a statement to Detective Wesley Roach, Rex would recount everything that happened on the farm that morning, including the sketchy black car, and describe the driver, who Rex did not know or recognize, as a white man with glasses, a black jacket, and gloves on. He was also able to show the police officers the route that the car took, and detectives were able to make casts of the tire tracks. Rex wasn't the only witness, though. A woman by the name of Jenny Conley, who managed the Hardys, which apparently was the place to be in this town, because nearly everyone involved in the case either stopped by or planned to stop by the Hardys the day of the murder.
Hardys is good.
I can't disagree. I actually have a specific breakfast order there, and I haven't been in years, so, like, I need to go. She later recounted her first customer of the day, who she described as wearing a white Oxford shirt and black wire-rimmed glasses with kind of slender, average height and dark hair that's kind of feathered on the side. She said that he seemed like he was in a hurry and nervous, upset that he had to wait for the correct food. When he sped away after slamming his money down on the counter, Miss Conley took note of the man's vehicle. Wouldn't you know, it was a black four-door car with a gray interior.
Hmm. You know, if we didn't already know this guy was a piece of shit, I mean, he's rude to, like, restaurant staff, too. Just seals the deal.
You're on your way to commit a murder, and you don't keep a low profile?
Right.
It's just, this man really thought he was invincible. Tommy Burke's autopsy would later confirm what was already very apparent to those who witnessed the horrific scene. Dr. Harlan, and I'm quoting a summary of his report, stated that the bullet entered the victim's body at the junction of the left side of the bridge of the nose and the left eyebrow, and then traveled through the brain and was recovered in the posterior right calvarium. The victim's wound was a distant gunshot wound, meaning that the barrel of the weapon was at least 24 inches from the victim's body when it was fired. Tommy Burks was assassinated at point-blank range on his own farm on his granddaughter's birthday. The only words I have to describe that are tragic and senseless.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, back in Arkansas, that's where Byron went to go see his friend. Byron Looper was once again arriving at Joe Bond's house, unannounced, nightmare, sometime between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. the night of October 19th.
Double nightmare.
A nervous and fidgety Looper walked into Bond's apartment where he proceeded to say the following. I did it, man. I did it. I killed that dude. That guy I was running against. I busted a cap in that dude's head. He then said to Bond, you'll cover my ass on this, won't you? And then followed up with, if you walked in your dress blues with all those medals you've got, that would be the best alibi I could ever have.
How did Looper get a gun if Bond never provided one to him?
Don't worry, Looper left little to the imagination. He told Bond that he used a 9mm pistol that he had gotten from a guy he knew that either had a business or went to police auctions, went to gun shows, things like that. There was a lot of discussion during trial about where this gun originated, and if you thought this town couldn't get smaller, think again. By March 1999, the gun had been recovered. It was found in two parts, the magazine and the pistol, which were both turned into law enforcement and quickly identified as the gun that killed Burke. Part of the reason it was identified was because the magazine had law enforcement use only emblazoned on it. Eventually, they were able to tie this gun all the way back to the mayor of Monterey, John Bowden, who paid an officer $700 in cash to purchase him two 9mm Smith & Wessons. After being bought and sold, it eventually ended in the lap of our villain, Byron Looper.
Okay, a little sketchy behavior from the mayor, I will say, but yeah, crazy small town.
Right? And it does back up the story that he told Bond that he bought it from someone who went to police auctions. Eyewitnesses, including a former housekeeper, would later place the gun in Looper's possession on multiple occasions. But back at the crime scene, Detective Wesley Roach didn't have all of this information. What he had was an assassinated state senator, a description of a black four-door car, and a white man with glasses. But his big break was right around the corner. The morning after Burke's death, Wesley Rex, the farmhand, went over to a fellow farmworker's house to see if he was coming into work, probably debrief about the events from the day before, and watch the news. I can only imagine what must have been going through Rex's head when he saw the face of none other than candidate for Tennessee State Senate Byron Looper on the television. Rex got a hold of Detective Roach as quickly as he could and declared that he was 100% sure that the man he saw in the car that shot Tommy Burke was his rival, Byron Looper. The police were already circling Looper, but when Joe Bond finally grew a backbone and decided to tell the police everything he knew, the walls finally came crashing in on our assassin. 4 days after the killing, on October 23rd, 1998, Looper returned to his home in Cookeville, Tennessee. But instead of a homecoming, he had handcuffs. But of course, before his arrest, which occurred without incident, a smug Looper offered the officers some sodas. It took a year for this case to go to trial, but once it did, it was a slam dunk for the prosecution. The defense attempted to argue that Looper was innocent due to his demonstrated ability to lose elections without resorting to violence, which is kind of a bizarre position to take, but no one was convinced. In August 2000, Looper was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without chance of parole after the victim's family requested that the death penalty not be used in this case. I do always like when the family's requests are, you know, taken into consideration.
Absolutely, and things like I agree.
That's important. In a move that will surprise no one, in 1999, Looper was removed as Putnam County tax assessor. But after his murder conviction, all of the other charges that were pending against him were dismissed. I guess they figured he's already spending life in prison. let's just give up on the guy.
He's not going to be a very good tax assessor.
No. Looper died in his Morgan County Correctional Prison cell on June 26, 2013, after serving roughly 14 years in prison for the assassination of Tommy Burke. While his autopsy would list a heart event as his cause of death, it did not happen under unsuspicious circumstances. I'm quoting the Nashville Scene article here, saying an incident report released days later said he, Looper, had hit a pregnant prison counselor in the head just before 9 a.m., was restrained by guards with the least amount of force necessary, and returned to his cell, where he was found dead 2 hours later. An inmate at the same prison complex wrote a letter to his girlfriend the day of Looper's death, saying, "I need you to get me away from this prison. The guards are crazy. I just seen them kill a man today." When Burke's daughter Hayes learned of Looper's death, she said, quote, "Looper got the easy way out. He didn't have to spend the rest of his life in jail and suffer." At sentencing, Horace Burks, Tommy's brother, testified that Tommy was a leader in the family and that his son was traumatized from how he passed. Kim Baylock, Tommy's daughter, testified to the impact the murder had on her daughter, who suffered panic attacks as a result. She said that Looper, quote, "took my grandma and my mama, because my grandma, it's just, it took everything out of her. My mama has lost 40 pounds.
Oh, that's devastating.
I know. It's horrible to see someone just, you know, have to battle grief like that.
So I hate to ask, what about the election?
I mean, that's what everyone's thinking, right? Surely Looper couldn't have won while facing murder charges. Due to Tennessee law at the time, which has since been changed, Byron Low-Tax Looper's name was the only one on the ballot for state senate. But no one, not even Looper's own party, was willing to let the man accused of Burke's murder walk into the state house as an elected official. Almost immediately after his death, there was a massive write-in campaign organized to elect Burke's wife, Charlotte, to his seat. She won, garnering 90% of the vote, and went on to serve as Tennessee State Senator until she retired in 2014, 1 year after Looper's death. Isn't that amazing?
Incredible. I love it.
So that is the story of Byron Low-Tax Looper, a lowbrow murderer who, in the end, actually ended up costing taxpayers quite a bit through his financial schemes and long prison stay.
That one was a doozy.
Sarah, do you want to gavel us out?
Absolutely.